what is it?
March 4th.
Meeting of the Clark County Historic Preservation Commission to order. And just a brief announcement that when you're speaking, please make sure you're close enough to the microphone that it picks up your voice. And we'll start with approving the February 5th meeting's minutes. And I'll give the commission a few minutes to look over those meeting minutes. Oh, right. Okay, we'll start with roll call and introductions. I'm Alex Gall, chair, and we'll go around to my left.
Don Trost, member.
Hi. Sharon Lumontovin, Clark County.
Jan Bader, City of Vancouver.
Mark Person, City of Vancouver.
Andy Gregg, commission member.
Brock Manley, commission member.
Michelle Kapitanovich, commission member.
Yeah, and then we have some guests today, and we'll have them introduce themselves.
Greg Griffiths, Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation.
Dennis Wardlaw, Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation.
All right, thanks. So has everybody had a chance to review last month's meeting minutes?
Yes.
I was absent, so I'll abstain from voting, but I'll entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. It moves. It passes. So the first item on the agenda is the Clark County Historic Museum Speaker Series on August 6th with a Historic Preservation Commission panel. And I think what we're looking for are volunteers to populate that panel.
In August.
We are the topic.
Oh, sorry. Well, you just did a presentation.
I know, but I will not be here August.
Yeah. That's right.
I will have been 48 hours removed from.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's true of, I think, three of us here tonight?
Well, right. I'll be off the commission, actually, in July.
Right. So. June for me. June. I beat you.
It doesn't leave a lot of options.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a few people here. So, I mean, the record should note that Sean is absent and Julie is also absent from tonight's meeting. So are those the only two?
Yeah.
August 6th?
Yeah. August 6th.
I'll volunteer.
Okay. All right, anybody? I'll see if...
Do we have time?
Yeah, I'll see if Julie and Sean are interested, too. So I'll put you down as a yes.
And the more the merrier, the more people there are, the less individual lifting needs to be done.
I'll volunteer if I'm reappointed.
Okay. That's good. That's a fair deal. We actually have a PowerPoint that we've used. So we can, whoever's doing it, we can provide you with the PowerPoint and you can fiddle with it.
You have a ventriloquist too? I think
no.
Okay.
No, but it's pretty... plug and play, yeah. So, okay, so far we have Don and Andy, and then we'll see if Julie and Sean are interested. We have some upcoming conferences to consider. The Revitalize Washington Conference is August 6th through the 8th in Wenatchee, Washington. Do we have any?
April, sorry.
Nobody's expressed interest.
Nobody's expressed interest in that?
Julie expressed interest in the unreinforced masonry. She said she could go. So we could allocate funding for her to do that from the budget.
I went to the Revitalize Washington one up in Port Townsend, one or 2 years ago?
It was 2 years ago.
And it was really educational and entertaining. And actually, we presented about the Jefferson Davis Memorial delisting.
I was just telling Dennis about that.
Yeah, it was an interesting time. So, and then the last conference of note is the NACP conference in Tacoma in late July, and that's the national conference.
But Julie and Michelle have confirmed that they can attend that. We have grant funding, CLG grant funding, for three people.
We also have our own budget, so we could add more people. So if anybody want to use that third?
I had volunteered for that.
Oh, did you? Okay.
If I'm reappointed.
Okay.
And, you know, I think that conference would be a really good conference for any new members.
Oh, that's true.
Who are coming on to the commission to go to, because that would get them, I think,
speed.
Up to speed and oriented.
Okay.
Quicker than attending one meeting a month for 6 months.
Okay.
So, and then the last topic that we have for our business, this is going to go quick, is the CLG grant application. And I was a little unclear, based on the notes that went out pre-meeting, what we were doing, I mean, how these topics came to be, and maybe Sharon, you can help us out on that.
So we talked about topics. There was a list that DAP provided what their priority topics were, and we chose these two from that priority list. And then they couldn't decide what you wanted us to do, and so we were going to have you narrow it down, flesh it out a little bit more, and have you choose one or prioritize in case we don't have time to flesh out two grant applications.
Okay.
And so these were what we thought. There's a couple options here. We just need to discuss a little bit more and see where you wanted to go with it.
Did we have any discussion prior to the narrowing down to these two, or was that just chosen by staff?
It was chosen by the commission based on the priority list for staff. Okay. They had like five topics. Three of them weren't applicable to us, and there were two that were. And then we thought, this would be interesting. Which one do you want? And then we weren't ready to make a decision, so we fleshed out a little bit more.
Okay.
And so what you're looking for is for us to pick one.
Or at least prioritize. If we only have time for one, which one would it be?
Okay. You know.
Are we encouraged to have a discussion now?
Yeah.
About those
and then come to a decision.
So the two topics are a mid-century modern historic context statement for Clark County, and I assume City of Vancouver. At the same time,
it'll be focused on Vancouver. With if there were buildings in the county that were significant, we could. It's not focused on the actual buildings; it's the historic context.
Right. So it's sort of a high elevation
view
of mid-century development. Okay. and the other topic is unreinforced masonry building, presumably, and seismic upgrades and all of that.
Unfortunate that Sean's not here because he also was promoting pushing this one, but there's a couple different directions we could go on this one, and one is Washington State already has an inventory. Seattle has a lot of their properties listed. Portland also went through this process. We could inventory buildings, but there's some, what does that get you to think about? So know where they are and then what? Or could we do something like pick the top five unreinforced buildings and maybe use these funds to hire structural engineer to come and assess it and see what would retrofits be. So then you've got something maybe the property owners would be willing to fund it later, I don't know. Or you do a workshop for property owners in general to see if.
Well, it was interesting looking at the Portland example that was included, and I mean it's a sort of a GIS-based product that, but again, it looked good, and you're able to find all these buildings, but then after that I was sort of like, well, this is just information that's available through the assessor's webpage.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I don't know if there's new information, but I also didn't dive very deep into it.
Yeah.
So,
Portland.
What do we do with the information other than make it available to people? We can't force anyone to take any actions, right?
Well, I mean, I suppose
what do we gain out of it, or what does the county gain out of it?
Maybe gaining an understanding of how many buildings that are at risk, and what would getting them seismically upgraded look like? I mean, and maybe identifying the top 10 buildings most at risk or something like that, or I don't know, but I would want there to be some tangible outcome that would be useful for future planning of masonry buildings.
Right, I can see where for us the information is useful
when we think in terms of like the laundry building at the Academy site or the church over here that's in question,
mm-hmm.
And how we can be proactive in helping people toward paths that would allow those structures to be preserved in some respect. For the county in general, I mean, it's a big life safety issue for our planners and building department folks who are here. And Portland has really taken a pretty advanced run at that with their requirements and their posting of unreinforced masonry buildings and public awareness of the hazards. So outside of that.
How much money are we talking about?
We have, 2 years ago, we had a grant for about $18,000. I mean, like 10 to 18,000?
Yeah. Somewhere. Because, you know, the historic context statement, I always like, you know, those context statements. But, I mean, quite frankly, we have a lot of those in the form of the cultural resource reports that get written. Now, they don't generally make it out into the public for the public to get to, but it really shouldn't cost that much to write
about 10. Make a
to write the context statement.
Yeah.
I mean, I looked at the one. I looked at the Spokane one, and now you know, I was like, oh, it wouldn't take that long to put that together. I don't know, but so anyway, Sean, you've joined us. We're discussing the CLG grant topics. If you couldn't tell,
one thing that I would add on the unreinforced masonry is, I gave Sharon some notes on this one. Is the opportunity to actually avoid the mistakes that Portland made. Because, you know, I presented at the American Institute of Architects National Colloquium on Historic Buildings and Building Codes last month, and, you know, the Portland project was actually discussed, and there's one person who was on that working group, and they made a lot of mistakes, you know. Basically, the working group's feedback was completely ignored by the city. So, you know, I think that as we move forward in Clark County, there's an opportunity. Not all the lessons that you learned are positive lessons. And so I think for us to have a kind of a more rational approach to how we approach this issue in Clark County, there's an opportunity here for that.
Well, and, you know, I think we're also seeing that, you know, these buildings, after a certain point, they become a health and human safety issue, and that is playing a role in their demolition.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and when I first looked at these two topics, I was pretty gung-ho about the mid-century modern context statement, but after getting a little deeper into it and thinking about outcomes and positive, tangible outcomes, it seems like the unreinforced, and in light of the last several months of dealing with a certain unreinforced masonry building complex, that feels like this is the time is right, and also the church, and you know, there are others certainly that I would hate to see go, because you know, a new owner comes in and says, oh, I can't afford to do this or that, and at least having some document out there with information and options and stuff would, I think, help.
And also guidance. You know, I think recognizing that the way that these buildings are actually treated by the codes that are in effect, so the International Existing Buildings Code actually addresses unreinforced masonry existing buildings and when you have to do a seismic upgrade. And that's not always followed. You know, people think, oh, if I'm going to do this project, I have to do a seismic upgrade. And then there's also the approaches to, you know, seismic stiffening is often kind of a mid-rise approach. And we've got a bunch of low-rise unreinforced masonry projects, not just mid-rise. So making sure that we have guidance for that is specific to the population that we have here in Clark County, as opposed to, say, Seattle or even Portland, where, you know, one of their big concerns is cornices falling off of buildings into the right-of-way. And that's not as big of a concern with the kind of masonry buildings that we have. It's still a concern, but it doesn't drive things as much. So having a solution that's really tailored toward our unreinforced masonry population, I think, could be really useful.
Sounds like, is that where you're leaning?
I think I'm probably on board with the unreinforced masonry topic, surprising myself.
Well, I'd like to speak in favor of the unreinforced masonry buildings and earthquakes proposal, because owners of the property may be very appreciative and actually take some action on the recommendations, whereas the mid-century modern historic context sounds like a master's thesis for somebody at WSU Vancouver, and we would have the same contribution to knowledge, and it would be more readily available than a report that's going to be pigeonholed and maybe never referenced except by the museum potentially. So I think out of respect for the owners, and the work might also encourage them to put those unreinforced masonry buildings on the historic register. And so it may have additional benefits.
And following up what you just said, Andy, the report might also, for folks with a certain mindset, might discourage them from putting their buildings on the historic register. So I think we might consider some kind of public information outreach, providing information and resources for those building owners that would help them toward a decision of not demolishing a building if that was the only choice they felt they had.
Yeah, there's definitely the opportunity for that. You know, when you look at the International Existing Buildings Code, it has a chapter for historic buildings that gives you a different compliance path through the code than other existing buildings. So, you know, life safety is life safety, regardless of what kind of building it is. But, you know, it shows how the approach might look a little bit different for a designated building, and sometimes that's one of the advantages of designating.
I would just hope that key to this would be accessibility and public access to this. And that was one of the nice things about the Portland thing, was that it had an online, publicly accessible element to it, which would be nice. So I guess we just choose a topic now, and then we kind of talk about how it shakes out. I mean,
we flesh it out and we bring it back in April. It's just trying to bring it back in April, a draft grant application.
And would it go out to bid for consultant firms?
Yeah, if we get the award, then we would go out to bid.
Okay. So we should vote on this, right? Yeah. So I'll entertain it sounds to me like the discussion is headed in the direction of unreinforced masonry buildings being the choice. Michelle, do you have?
No, I have nothing to add.
Okay. So I'll entertain a motion to undertake the unreinforced masonry buildings and earthquakes topic.
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? So moved. Okay, so I think now we're moving on to, we have no other business, correct? Okay. Just a brief note. I did get a nice note here, a thank you note from Julie McGraw, just thanking us for the historic promotion grant for the Capitol Plank House Collections Project. And she says, we are thrilled to have conducted a thorough review of our collections and are looking forward to sharing the information with others. And we now have better relationships with our Indigenous partners. We are truly grateful. So, nice. Thank you, Noah.
Very good.
And with that, I will turn it over to
Dennis Wardlaw from Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation.
Thank you. I guess this is on. I've never used the microphone like this. You'll have to excuse me. I am subbing in for Stephanie Jolivet. She's our local government's archaeologist, and she handles the local government reviews for the west side of state, the west side of the state, and does a lot of work for Clark County local governments. She's taken ill, so I'll be giving her a PowerPoint presentation that she put together. So I guess we're going to be talking about DAP, cultural resource laws, and I guess some of the functions of DAP. I'm sorry, for advancing the slides.
You're okay.
Sorry, 1 second.
Dennis, how do you spell your last name?
Wardlaw, W-A-R-D-L-A-W.
Thank you.
Next. So my name is Dennis Wardlaw, and I'm a transportation archaeologist at DAP. I do mostly transportation reviews, but I do help out with the local government reviews. I help Stephanie out for that. We do a lot of reviews for Clark County and the cities within Clark County. And so I'm going to talk about DAP, the basics of cultural resources and how we categorize them within the DAP, the basics about cultural resource laws, and give you some ideas about how we make decisions at DAP, and some other ideas about how planners can help to manage risk to projects and get your projects through the process more easily. So the Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation is it's an offshoot of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. Basically, that law states that any kind of time you have federal funds, reviews, or permits, there has to be an accounting for cultural resources. It also kind of lays the framework for each state to have a state historic preservation officer. And the Allison Brooks is the Washington State Historic Preservation Officer. And she's our agency director. There's also RCW 2734, and so there's a state and federal nexus for cultural resource reviews within Washington State. Next. So the Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation is Washington's primary agency with knowledge and expertise in archaeology, historic preservation, and the recovery of non-forensic human remains. So there's three main areas: regulatory, economic development, and also historical and cultural data management. And that's our wizard system, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And DAP is the central repository for that cultural and data management. Next slide. So you can see that in our repository, we have a lot of information on file. And I had our records managers pull the information to kind of tailor it for this talk. In Clark County, we have 1,192 sites out of 35,000 plus sites. 19,913 properties that have been evaluated in some manner. 76 properties that are on the National Register. 4,193 surveys that have been done in Clark County, and 74 cemeteries. So you can see there's a lot going on in the state of Washington and a lot going on in Clark County. So next slide.
74 cemeteries?
Yeah. Is that? Well, yeah, a lot of these are like
two or three people in them.
Yeah. So cultural resources can be defined as physical evidence or a place of past human activity, like a building or a site, object, landscape, or structure, or a site, structure, landscape, object, or natural feature of significance to a group of people traditionally associated with it. Next. And cultural resource environments include archaeology, the built environment, and cultural landscapes. Next. Archaeology is the study of interpretation and reconstruction of human behavior based on upon an investigation of physical evidence of human activities. We have an example of a large excavation process, artifacts that are recovered, and some of the more complex stratigraphy you can see on sites. Next. So examples are just a basic description of archaeological resources. They can be Native American and defined usually as pre-contact, prehistoric, historic, or multi-component combining pre-contact, prehistoric, and historic periods. Next. So we're getting into the built environment, which I have to be quite honest, that work is done by Greg Griffith and other folks on the other side of the building. I defer to their expertise, but we have some useful definitions here. For historic preservation, urban planning, landscape, architecture, and sustainability, very critical functions for built environment, built environment resources. And next slide. So just kind of an overview picture of like what we consider to be the built environment, building structures, objects, landscapes, so you kind of get an idea. Cultural landscapes, like, I think that's, is that Eby's Preserve, the top slide?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that's Eby's Preserve. That's a national
historic reserve.
The Columbia River Gorge is another example of a cultural landscape. So next slide. Why are we concerned about cultural resources? Well, they're non-renewable in the sense that once you excavate an archaeological site, it doesn't replenish itself over time. It's gone. And that's very concerning. Next slide. One second. I apologize if this, I was not prepared as I should be for filling in, but here I am. So there are a lot of reasons not just to care. Endangered species, increased demolition and construction, and increased populations all contribute to the loss of resources. Modern building techniques are more destructive than previous. Rising sea levels are a major concern for archaeological resources. A 2017 study on the East Coast showed that a meter rise in a sea level would destroy more than 13,000 archaeological sites. And similar studies have not been done for Washington State. So we're concerned because, people care more than you think. That's kind of a reason folks are here tonight, because they are concerned. And underestimating concerns of the community can lead to costly delays and canceled projects. Next slide. A big concern we have with the reviews we do is finding these things during construction. Discovering resources during projects can be costly, both in time and money. This is a picture of Oak Harbor dirt piles. I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with that project. That was a project that happened maybe 10, 15 years ago. The Pioneer Way, I think it was called, and that led to severe delays and millions of dollars in project overruns when it could have been avoided. A few human remains were impacted with this project. The work did not stop. Originally, a small area would have been impacted by work stoppage. Human remains got mixed up in these piles, and so all the dirt had to be sifted by hand, and it had to be covered by the city. I think every member of the city council and the mayor was voted out of office on the next election, so don't let this happen to you. Next slide. Why be concerned? It's the law. Myriad of laws protect cultural resources. Failure to follow those laws have consequences both for the project and the lead agency. And so, many categories, federal, state, local government requirements, archaeology and human remains specific. But we'll get into that in a little bit more in just a few. Next slide. So this next slide just kind of shows you that you know, there's most countries now have laws governing cultural resources. Few don't. Poor, war-torn regions usually are the ones that don't account for cultural resources. Next slide. So under state statute, DAFC regulates archaeological sites and excavations, Indian graves and records, preservation and maintenance of abandoned cemeteries, inadvertent discoveries of non-forensic human remains. We have a state physical anthropologist that works with our agency and handles those cases. And he stays pretty busy. Next slide. So I guess it's worth reading. On the private and public lands of the state, it is shall be unlawful for any person, firm, corporation, or agency, or institution of the state, or political subdivision thereof, to knowingly remove, alter, dig into, or excavate by use of any mechanical, hydrologic, or any other means, or to damage, deface, or destroy any historic or prehistoric archaeological resource or site, or remove any archaeological object from such site, unless they have obtained a permit from DAP in advance. We handle a fair amount of permits through the state. We also do have changed the rules recently to allow for monitoring, which is a little less time-consuming, and so far it's been working out fairly well, I think, for folks. Next slide. This law includes recorded and unrecorded sites on both public and private lands, and applies to professional archaeologists and tribal archaeologists as well. This example of a fish weir from a Puget Sound region. Next slide. Some basic definitions covered in RCW 2753. Archaeological sites include a geographic locality in Washington, including but not limited to submerged lands containing archaeological objects. Archaeological objects are the physical evidence of an indigenous and subsequent cultural, including material remains of past human life, including monuments, symbols, tools, facilities, and technological byproducts. Professional archaeologist is a minimum of a master's degree, and these are all in the RCWs. Okay, next slide. So artifacts recovered from an excavation on public land must be curated. Artifacts recovered from an excavation on private lands are the property of a landowner, but we strongly encourage donation to a museum. Next slide. All disturbance, excavation, or other alteration of Indian graves, cairns, or glyptic records requires an excavation permit from DAP. It's universal grave protection for all, and applies to graves on all lands, state, county, city, and private. Next slide. So common questions. Why do I have to do a survey, but the project up the road is not? Why does the section of the road need monitoring? Why do we need to assess this old building and not the one next door? These are the questions I have gotten many times over myself. It's just, we're not trying to pick on anyone, but we do our reviews case by case, and we assess a suite of factors, you know, considering the probability or the sensitivity of the project area for archaeological resources, known sites in the area. So it's not just we don't like this the property developer, or we don't want this project to go through. We're agnostic on the merits of each project, or we try to be. And we just try to take these on a case-by-case basis. Next slide. You know, like I said, so we consider a suite of factors, the impacts, the previous history, and we also look at research, the previous work that's done on these sites. Next slide. So I guess we just launched a new version of Wizard. It's on an online GIS platform that contains all their cultural resource information for the state. It's a very powerful tool that is available for cultural resource practitioners.
There's also a public side that's available. And as a planner, you can do some of the research yourself, as our planners if they're here. So the WISARD actually stands for the Washington Information System of Architectural and Archaeological Records and Data. And so the public side, you can see buildings, the properties, the inventories that have been done, the information derived from its assessors, and also properties listed on the Washington or National Register of Historic Places. Also, historic districts are that layer is available. Next slide. We also have GLO maps, which are very useful historic maps that kind of, you can look at them, I guess, by section, township, and range. So if you're looking at a particular parcel in some area of Clark County and you're just kind of worried about, concerned about the history of the area or just curious, you can take a look. And we have most of the state, the GLOs referenced. We're exploring the idea of getting Sanborn maps. Those are like early fire maps, fire insurance maps from the early 20th century, and we're trying to get them, and hopefully we can get them geo-referenced and available to the public. There's also a very good research tool.
Is there a time frame for the Sanborns?
For Washington State, I guess it's like late 19th century to the 20s or 30s, maybe? 1920s or 30s, maybe?
I mean, when you said you're in the process of trying to get them integrated.
We have no funding, so it could be a while. Maybe that's something we can think about later on.
And then you can do Metzger maps, too.
Yeah. Next slide. So I think I touched on this a little earlier. We also have a predictive model that we reference. This looks at like a suite of features, topography, distance to water, slope aspects. And this kind of gives us a general sense of sensitivity for archaeological resources because, you know, folks, you know, throughout time, they want to be on the high ground close to water and kind of meshing that data gives us a good idea of where we might expect to see archaeological sites. It's not like a very precise surgical laser scalpel, but it does give a very good idea for sensitivity for different areas within the state.
Is that accessible on the public side of WISARD?
It is accessible on the public side as well. So, planners are often put in a position where they have to decide what projects need to be concerned about cultural resources. And so, let's see. Next slide. Okay, let's just move on to the secure side of WISARD. As I mentioned before, the location of archaeological sites are protected. Professional archaeologists and cultural resource professionals have access to additional data. Archaeological sites, archaeological districts, cemeteries, and survey reports. So when you give me when you get Stephanie on the phone and she says, "Hold on, I'm looking at the database," that's what she's doing. You can get additional information through the DAP data share agreement. That's something that our office does with local governments, which we kind of clip the data and personalize it to the county or city or whatever local government's interested in having the secure side for, well, not all of the secure side, but more than it's available on the public side for that local government so they can do reviews. If Clark County, I think Clark County does have one with a DAP. Next slide. So the many kinds of cultural resource professionals, archaeologists with advanced degrees, but also have historians, architectural historians, historical architects. Next slide. So it's a balancing act for doing a review for sure. So when you send a project to DAP review, I mentioned that we consider a suite of factors. And we do this because we seek to find a balance between protecting cultural resources and also minimizing risks to the projects. We take a variety of recommendations based on these two points of view, including costs, but also just risks to cultural resources. And it's all about managing risks, and as we'll see, we'll get into in the next slide. So I guess you can, if you do recall, there was a case a while back in Seattle, the Showbox Menu. And after demolition was planned, the community rose up to fight it, lawsuits, the city council here has caused massive delays to the project. And there's still a lot of contention going on for this project that will probably play out for years to come. These are delays that happened because the project proponents and planners underestimated the importance of a resource to the community. So it's better to explore all potential issues in advance. Next slide. Archaeological resources are a risk to projects too. Actually, go back one. I'm sorry. I forgot to mention the slide down below. That's another picture from Oak Harbor. I think this is their wastewater treatment plant that went in a few years ago. And archaeological resources are a risk to projects as well. If they're found late in the process, they can cost more money and it can upset your schedule. So this issue happened where they found human remains for this project. But after hiring a cultural resource professional and consulting with tribes in advance of projects, they avoided most of the issues. Now we're going to move on to levels of recommendations that DAPS makes. Next slide. So lowest risk, archaeologists gets out there and surveys in advance just to make sure that, there's some concern, but not too much. But we just want to be sure. There's suite of factors, just kind of close to water, high ground, never been surveyed before. Next slide. Higher risk, cultural resources observe excavations. It's only recommended in specific circumstances due to risk. If archaeology or human remains are found, the project stops. You may need a permit at that point. Inadvertent discoveries can cost a lot of money. We recommend surveys when there is a chance that sites may be deeply buried or under hardscaping or buildings. Finding sites this way is also highly destructive to the resources. Sites can be destroyed, human remains can be disturbed. Thank you. We all get the idea. So it's all about managing the risk. Next slide. We just set that. Next slide. So I think this. Stephanie also prepared a few slides on the predetermination process that Clark County and some of the local governments are involved with. So I have only dealt with the predetermination process myself a few times, but Stephanie does have a few notes, so you'll have to be patient with me. Predetermination surveys are a system that is only utilized in Clark County in the state of Washington. During the initial permit applications stages, the city planners, in the case of Vancouver, tell applicants that they need to hire an archaeologist to conduct a predetermination survey on their property. DAP is not directly involved in this stage of the process. The city uses a cultural resource predictive model, the type and size of the project, to determine who needs a survey. This is the basic understanding our agency has for this process. If there are any planners here, they can maybe speak to this process a little bit more. A predetermination survey is typically a very small scale survey, something that at the DAP we would consider a reconnaissance survey rather than an intensive survey. I think the requirement is about one shovel test per acre, which the archaeologist conduct a full service survey of the project area, recording any artifacts on the surface and general conditions. Then they dig a small number of holes to look for the archaeologist below the surface. If archaeology is found, further work is needed. If no archaeology is found, the majority of the time the project needs no further work. That becomes involved when a predetermination report is completed. The report is uploaded to our online wizard system. The staff provides an email receipt to the archaeologist stating that we received a copy of the report. Then the email goes to the city, and then the permitting process is allowed to move forward. The important point for our current discussion is that DAP cannot conduct a review of the process at the predetermination stage. When the report is written, the archaeologist often has very little information about the extent and depth of ground disturbance plan. There's no way to know at this stage if the area surveyed during the predetermination is the same area that will eventually be developed. The size and area of the project often changes. The next step is in the CEPA review process. The DAP receives a copy of the CEPA checklist, preferably at the NOA notice of application, NOA stage. The CEPA checklist lets us know how deep they will dig, how much grading will occur. It includes plans showing the footprint of disturbance, hopefully. We then match up the CEPA with a predetermination already in our system, and it usually kind of is a fairly quick process to determine if further work is recommended. If an archaeological site is within the project footprint, then an excavation permit from our agency is will be needed. Not sure if you should go into details. An excavation permit is needed, but that's something that the archaeologist and Lance Woolwich, our assistant state archaeologist, can actually hash out the nuances of that. If no archaeology is found, but due to demolition debris, standing structures, flooding, or vegetation, the archaeologist was able to access areas of the project, the DAP may recommend further survey. If nothing is found and the predetermination covered the entire project area, DAP will likely recommend no further work. So the complications have been caused in the City of Vancouver by the City of Vancouver Downtown EIS. As part of the EIS, the City of Vancouver is exempting projects from CEPA review. This means that no opportunity for the DAP to provide comments on the actual permit. And Stephanie does raise, or DAP does have concerns. During projects in the downtown Vancouver area, the City of Vancouver is the lead agency. If archaeology is impacted and it is determined that an archaeological violation has been committed, the developer, landowner, and the city can be liable. If human remains are impacted, these monetary violations can become felony charges. Without a DAP review process, the city takes on full responsibility for safeguarding its cultural resources and also loses a free review service provided by the DAP.
So can I stop you for just a second? That was a whole bunch of information that you said in regards to the city's EIS process. And is there any way we could get a copy of what she's written down and have that copy for our records? Because that's a lot of information to take in all of a sudden,
yeah. You
know? And I think there was a lot of important information with what you just said right there. Mm-hmm. And I would like to be able to have that in writing in front of me so I can look at that and digest that a little bit more fully.
Sure.
Something like that possible?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Copy of these notes.
Okay, because I would really like to see those and have hard copies of that.
Okay. Sure. My colleague, Stephanie, has spoken with some of the city planners, and she tells me that some projects have been reviewed by the DAP a bit differently. In some cases, Vancouver city planners are sending DAP staff reports for review, which provides some of the same information in the CEPA checklist. The best solution would be for the city to set up a formal process to get permit documents to the DAP for the City of Vancouver projects. The DAP reviews a lot of different permits, not just CEPA documents, so we can be flexible as long as basic information is provided and along with the review period. Next slide. Just a few notes now that are about the Providence Academy. The Providence Academy, as you know, has encountered this exemption issue. For the Providence Academy, a predetermination survey was conducted and an archaeological site was found. Luckily, the same archaeological firm that worked on this predetermination is being utilized as the project moves forward, so that the developer was already aware that they needed a DAP permit. And the DAP permit application for phase one is currently under review. I say luckily because
did you say it's under review?
Yeah.
Is that what you said? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Luckily, because if the archaeologist had not continued to be under contract, the developer may have not known and the permit that the permit was required, and the site might have been found during construction, and that could have been a huge ordeal, and everyone would have been None too pleased. So without a CEPA review, the DAP did not have an opportunity to send a letter outlining the requirements. DAP didn't also have an opportunity to review the built environment impacts. Building tall structures in close proximity to a historic structure can have a significant impact on its eligibility. This is something that Greg can address further in the next talk. Demolishing historic period buildings, these are especially BE resources as old as and interesting historically as the Laundry and Smokestack should also include a review by the DAP. And then as a note, demolition of these historic buildings will likely require a permit from the DAP, as the demolition will likely impact the nearby archaeological site, although we need to review the plans to determine this. So, in conclusion, we have seen multiple EISs from around the state that attempt to exempt projects within the larger area from review. Stephanie has seen many larger housing developments go down this route, and it is always a battle to get them to treat cultural resources appropriately. This is dangerous, and it often leads to archaeological sites being impacted. And once a site is discovered during construction, it can significantly delay the projects and cost more than money than doing an initial survey and review. DAP is always happy to work with the city to find a review process for projects within the city EIS area that works. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
Does anybody on the commission have any questions for Dennis after that?
I second Michelle's request. It would be nice to have an understandable kind of reviewable summary of what the process is, you know, in DAP size and, you know, what we should expect to see.
I'm sorry. So are you wanting these notes sent, or are you wanting to?
I want those notes.
Yeah.
Give them to me.
Read to us.
Yeah.
Okay, I will.
Email them to me, or?
Yeah, I can give you these notes, or I can email you a copy.
How can or should a planner integrate DAP into the CEPA process? Because a lot of times it's first of all, the predetermination, you know, this Clark County unique and City of Vancouver, it's very archaeology centric. It doesn't really, the language doesn't really account for the built environment. And then, you know, the review doesn't happen at DAP until the CEPA checklist is submitted, and it's often very late in the game. I mean, the development is pretty much a foregone conclusion at that point. And so do you guys have a way to encourage planners to get in touch with your agency earlier in the CEPA process than waiting for that checklist that comes in at the 11th hour before you guys review any documents associated with it? Do you guys have a means to encourage jurisdictions to engage earlier?
No, not with the CEPA process. We're kind of constrained with our CEPA review, but that being said, we're always happy to engage, like, outside of the process. We encourage, like, consultation early and often. We know that these things will eventually, or most of the time, end up following the CEPA process. We can't really give, like, a formal review, but we can engage and give our advice on the project or the work that is being contemplated for the cultural resources review, for the work that's been done.
I know that CEPA is interpreted differently at the local level. I mean, jurisdiction has their CEPA. And I'm wondering, are there any jurisdictions in the state that you know of that have it built in where state agencies such as DAP or ecology or something are consulted earlier than the CEPA checklist stage?
I think it depends. Some of the other mechanisms for review, the Shoreline Management Act, I think, so we get a lot of reviews for like Island and San Juan counties that happen, I think,
But that's outside of SEPA.
Yeah. No, I can't think of any other counties offhand. It's very broken up by the states. You know, a lot of state or counties apply exemptions that are just vary from one area to the next. So, if you look at a breakdown of the counties we review, we review maybe 5 projects from Garfield County, but Clark County, we need a full-time person, basically, mm-hmm. for our agency. The SEPA process is pretty well defined at this point for us. That being said, we are happy to engage planners earlier in the process if they feel like they want to reach out. We have an open door policy for folks.
And what kind of things could planners expect to learn about a upcoming project if they do access the public side of Wizard? Like what kind of information are you hoping that they take away from?
I guess an idea would be the archaeological sensitivity of the area, because that's one of a huge factor in our reviews. If a development's going in like far away from water on a 20% slope, that's not something we're going to be very concerned with. But something in Clark County, far away from moving water that hasn't been previously surveyed, or in their case, they're looking at an area that's high ground, close to water, and they can see that bright yellow or archaeological sensitivity layer. They can get an idea that when this review is conducted by us, that we're going to probably come back and say, we recommend a full-on archaeological survey for this property.
Okay.
Alex, if I could also add on to what Dennis said to answer or to respond to your question. I think Dennis, I think, has touched upon kind of the issues. One is that Stephanie is really one person in our office. So the workload is just amazing in terms of the projects that she's reviewing from throughout the state. And, she has, under the SEPA process, there's 2 weeks, in essence, for her to be able to process these, receive them, and be able to respond to them. And in the meantime, she's fielding, calls from property owners and applicants about what's happening and why we have to do this, and working with consultants. So it's really, that's part of the problem is that it's just the workload and the fact that we just don't have the staffing to, to do a real, as thorough and as complete kind of reviews as speedily as possible.
We conducted, I think, 6,700 SEPA reviews last year with just one full-time and 2 people helping out. So it's a lot of work for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I didn't remember the numbers, but thank you, Dennis. But the other thing is just the education part of it. So I think that in response to your question about how to encourage, I think that being able to present like at meetings like this, and as Sharon knows, Stephanie and I were here in Vancouver back in November, giving the presentation that Dennis presented at the Southwest Washington Regional Planners Forum. So I think that's kind of a real important kind of way that we can kind of encourage that. And I think as Dennis's or Stephanie's slide indicated, it's the bottom line is risk management. It's making the everyone aware of the risks that you are running in terms of not doing your survey work ahead of time and not being aware of the issues or thinking about what the possibilities or potentials are for encountering or damaging cultural resources in your project planning process. So that you know, we really try to make an effort, and that's why we have these kinds of presentations and those kinds of slides to make people aware of what the risks are and the importance of those resources are to people in our state. So it's just sort of a matter of getting the word out and doing education and outreach, but then balanced with the fact that, you know, we're very limited in terms of our abilities to be able to send that message out on a regular, ongoing basis.
So you had mentioned the downtown EIS. So when a project is approved as a planned action, does that come to you at all for review, or is the original sub-area plan EIS, that was your review opportunity?
Well, if it falls outside of the planned action ordinance or the supplemental EIS, I get it would, unless it's exempted, it would follow the normal CEPA process, and then we would see it as a notice of application and would have our ability to comment on that project then.
So if the planner determines that it does fall within the EIS as a planned action, then you wouldn't see it?
Greg could probably
have that
one.
I guess, Sean, I would say that it's my understanding that that our opportunity, everyone's opportunity, that is to comment on the planned action ordinance occurs at the point of the development of the EIS, and in the case of the Vancouver, the VCCV, was we reviewed and commented on the supplemental EIS back in 2007. So at that point, we did provide comments at that point and got responses back from the city based upon our comments. So, but it's my understanding that anything, any kind of contact or notification after the fact or at the point of an application of a proposal that's deemed to be a planned action come under the purview of the planned action ordinance that our involvement would be on a voluntary, or maybe not a voluntary, but a kind of courtesy basis, or a kind of an invitation, which did occur. Our historical architect Nicholas Van looked at the phase one project back in 2018, so did provide comments to Keith at that point. I think, but it is my impression that was. And I don't know because I didn't do that review, but it was my impression that was something that the applicant wanted to invited that kind of review for input on in terms of our comments and reviews of the project.
And I guess you know that gets to one of the points that I think we as a commission, and one of the reasons we wanted to hear from you is. There, you know, the CEPA process as it is applied in Clark County and the City of Vancouver is fairly well defined for archaeology. You know, we have this predetermination process, and then if something, you know, it's basically a presence or absence, and then if something's found, it goes to a formal survey and this and that. And you look at the CEPA checklist question number 13, the first question is about the built environment. Are there buildings in your project area over 50 years old that are listed on a register or eligible for listing on a register? But the way that Clark County and the City of Vancouver approach the CEPA process doesn't seem to adequately fit the built environment into the process, into the local process. And so what we're finding is that there are a lot of demolitions happening. You know, unfortunately, the CEPA has that language that, it, you know, is there a building that's eligible for listed on a register? Well, a lot of times the applicant has no idea. I mean, they'll just say no 9 times out of 10 without going any further than that. And that's basically where it ends. And so, you know, in my day job, my more savvy clients know to demolish the house before I get out there. So we get out there, and we're expecting a 1913 farmhouse, and we get a pile of rubble because they got a demolition permit. Easy as pie. So you know, we as a commission have struggled for about 2.5-3 years to try to figure out how to integrate a process to at least flag these structures before they're demolished, whether we record them, whether there's some sort of preservation aspect or review period. I mean, we've run through a lot of scenarios, and it seems like, and you know, I think the Academy kind of highlights this on a larger scale, but where does the built environment fit into the SEPA review process? And I think that's something we'd like to hear from you guys. I mean, even the presentation that Dennis gave was very archaeological centric. And, you know, I think that we're all fairly comfortable with that process as it stands. It's the question of the built environment and the quick rate of demolition that we're seeing, you know, as we have a pulse of increased development occurring right now in the county, and we're just seeing a lot of buildings disappearing with no trace of their, because once they're demolished, they get pulled off the Clark County GIS, and all that great information is no longer publicly accessible. So, you know, we're trying to wrestle with some means to document and or preserve these structures before they're gone. We were hoping that the SEPA process would allow for that. And
to add a little layer to that, you know, one of the reasons for that is that a lot of these are single-family homes. And so SEPA has built into it that if it wouldn't require a SEPA review to build it, then it doesn't require a SEPA review to tear it down. You know, that's, and single-family homes are categorically exempt from SEPA. So, you know, we see that there are the categorical exemptions that are built into SEPA that leave a pretty big hole for historic buildings that doesn't necessarily leave for archaeology, because that process is, because of the predictive models. I mean, when it comes right down to it, the predictive models really help identify potential archaeology in a way that it doesn't help identify historic buildings that get triggered by that process.
But you know, on the public side of Wizard, the HPI is available. You know, so you know, I was kind of hoping that when I asked that leading question that you were going to say, then a planner can see if there is a structure there. They don't have to rely on the SEPA checklist and the applicant filling it out to know whether there's a property that's in that project area that's over 45 years old and may be determined eligible for listing on a register.
We also have assessor's data, I guess it's pretty complete for Clark County, that, you know, person can go to a parcel and see that a property is over 50 years old just with a click of a button. It's built environment is definitely probably one of the more frustrating aspects of SEPA reviews. As you touched on, like, there's a lot of exemptions that happen for the old houses. And so we don't even see these houses. So, and then when we do, it's, you know, it can be very challenging to encouraging planners to condition the permits for cultural resource surveys, but getting them to also go out there and account for the built environment properties on the project area can be even more challenging and frustrating. It's something that should be revisited in the near future for the SEPA checklist. Question 13, there should be stronger language for encouraging people to account for built environment properties within the project area and to, like, encourage more avoid, minimize, and mitigation work going out there. It's definitely probably the most frustrating aspect of the SEPA review process for us.
I guess I would just add, Alex, that, you know, we're very much aware of what you're saying, and certainly, you know, Vancouver and Clark County are not, you know, alone, and there's probably one of you in probably every community, not only in Washington State or Clark County, but throughout the nation. In Washington State, though, archaeological resources have you know, pretty strong protections, as you know, since you work in the field, and so they have, you know, as we saw in the, you know, the slides, that there are laws that absolutely protect those. And again, that gets back to the point I made about risk management, and that it's really, to everyone's benefit to weigh the risks in terms of their approach to projects, project development, and reviewing and their designs. So, but that's, you know, as you know, that's not the case with the built environment. So what it boils down to, like Dennis said, is us being able to provide information about those resources and their significance and their eligibility for designation, if at all. And if so, it's just sort of a matter of asking for, you know, or requesting mitigation. So SEPA is really not, you know, there's really, it's really a notification and review and comment kind of a process. And so that is kind of our role, is providing, doing those reviews and providing those comments when we receive those checklists or determinations. That's basically what we're doing. So in our office, for example, by and large, the workload, the 6,700 reviews that Dennis mentioned, if that's the correct number, by and large, the issues that come to her are regarding cultural resources and archaeological resources, and then those that have both archaeological resources and the built environment resources, or just the built environment, like a single-family residence, will go to review by our built environment reviewer, Holly Borth. And again, you know, we provide comments to the jurisdiction with those kinds of recommendations. But again, those are comments, and there's no absolute kind of protections for those built environment resources. So I guess what I would go back to say is again, what our tool is, I'll say tool, is the information, the data. So like doing the inventory work, doing those evaluations, determining, you know, what's significant, what may not be significant, and putting into your comprehensive plans, your, whether it's the planned area ordinance, or whatever kinds of regulations, is in terms of accommodating for those evaluations and that data. So that's kind of basically our toolbox, and any kind of incentives or strategies that might mitigate or provide for preservation is kind of where, you know, what we can offer.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Are these questions at a minimum, and could a jurisdiction add checklist item 13? Could we add some more questions pertaining to the built environment, or is this?
Is the SEPA checklist, can a local jurisdiction edit it to their?
Can we add questions?
I don't know the answer to that question, Sharon. I know that the current SEPA checklist was, you know, there was a, many of you may know this, there was a few years ago, there was a state legislative mandate to review the SEPA process because of concerns of developers, property owners, and government agencies of the process being too cumbersome and duplicative and replicative and so forth and so on. And at that point, that was where a lot of the SEPA exemptions were raised, so that the thresholds were raised before those reviews. So that was a process that our staff, the SHPO, in fact, was involved in, and others, Washington Trust for Historic Preservation, with reservations about that and suggested strategies to ameliorate that, one of which was doing sub-area planning. But I don't know. And as a result of that, though, there was a fourth question added to the SEPA checklist. Previously, there were just the three, but that fourth one was added as a result of that process in order to get more information out, get more kind of detail about the proposal and how that might affect resources. So that was kind of a, in and of itself, that was kind of a long process to make that happen. But I don't know about locally adding on to that or refining those questions. I just don't know. That's a good question, Sharon.
So I kind of know the answer to that question.
Oh, Sean. Okay. Ask Sean.
The state legislation defines itself as establishing minimum standards for the SEPA process. And in places, it explicitly says that the local jurisdiction can adopt more stringent regulations as part of the SEPA process. The reason that it's, I only know that kind of the answer to that is, I don't know how broad that is. I know that in specific circumstances, the state legislation certainly allows the jurisdiction to add to it. I don't know if that's in all cases, though.
Yeah, that makes sense, John. Thank you for being on. I don't know why, you know, why it would be forbidden.
Yeah, it's not a building code, so like the building code is often a min-max. You know, the minimum established by the state is also the maximum that the jurisdictions can do. But SEPA isn't that. It's legislation. So I would imagine, but I'm not a lawyer. I do know that in places it explicitly says that the jurisdiction can require more.
But again, the way we treat it is a notification process and a way to be able to review and comment. So it's a notification that for us is really important to be able to know that our proposal project is being entertained, and us be able to provide our comments in terms of, well, you know, how that will affect what we know about the built environment and cultural resources.
So one question that I've had reading through it, it looks like if there's a substantial change to a project, it doesn't quite trigger the SEPA process to start all over again, but it does create a trigger for a reevaluation. You know, that the city can ask for more information, require additional mitigation measures. That seems to be how the process is set up, and when I'm reading it. So I'm curious about if there are any standards for, you know, how substantial a change before, or does it all really come down to the discretion of the planner? You know, how much change would require more information or more mitigation?
I guess I would say that comes down to the discretion of the planner to do that, since to make that determination. And we do make that, if you have seen our letters to, you know, to jurisdictions, you know, we do put that, it's boilerplate language, quite frankly, in our letters to say that that our review, our comments are based upon the information that we have available at the time of our review. But we also add the caveat that if new information is learned about the resource or the project changes or the location changes or any of those kinds of details, like depth of ground disturbance or whatever kind of maybe additional resources might be affected, you know, we expect, you know, notification to be able to revise our comments or review accordingly. Again, that's dependent upon, you know, that recognition being made.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. So projects, you know, as we all know, projects change quite frequently and sometimes substantially from the time that we, you know, we see them from their conceptual stage to actual groundbreaking. So
well, I know that was why Gretchen started only reviewing predeterminations once she got a SEPA checklist, because she said that she found herself reviewing the same, you know, a project that then changed substantially enough that, you know, and she'd be reviewing the same thing over and over. So
yeah.
I'm just going to wait until the SEPA checklist comes in, and that way I know
yes.
the real project.
Exactly.
And
again, that goes back to the workload issue.
Yeah, but it raises this, you know, cart and horse situation where it would be nice to hear from the DAP early in a project's planning so that the applicant knows what's there or what's potentially there or what to look out for, or if there's a historic building, what options they have instead of demolition and that kind of thing. But, you know, that's unless
yes.
there's something more, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a tough sell, I think.
Well, it's just, again, you know, we're trying to provide you with the tools to do that, to gather that information. And, you know, Wizard, the historic property inventory is, you know, you can go there right now from your cell phone and see that information. The predictive model is out there, and you know, you as an archaeologist have access to the confidential side of Wizard. So that's the tool for, you know, for that kind of information to be gathered. So providing that to Gretchen or Stephanie or whoever, Dennis, Holly, whoever in our office, the more information we have, the more informed and better our comments and recommendations can be. But again, it's, you know, it gets back to kind of that workload issue.
So when we were talking about the process, one of the slides talked about exemptions, and you talked about that with the subarea plan as, you know, projects being exempted. And that struck me, and maybe this is because I'm a codes guy, so I think of it differently. Because when I look through it, it looks like planned actions aren't exempted from SEPA. The planned action is the SEPA process. So it's not really an exemption from the SEPA process.
Right.
It's really an alternate compliance path. That's what we would call it in the codes world. And
I like that.
You know, and so it's, you know, planned action, EIS, is the EIS for the project.
Yes.
And, you know, I read both the state and, like, our local, and it gives conditions for when something can be approved as a planned action. And if it
right.
is supplemental. So it really does. So those projects are really still, they're going through
the
process.
I think that's a really good point, Sean, that process was the SEPA process. And at that point we did, you know, we did had reviewed the SEIS at that point. So, but I guess that there would be the expectation on our point that once we get more specifics about projects that come in under the planned action ordinance review process, that we would be able to review and comment on those, the more specific kind of aspects of those proposals. So
yeah, you talked about risk management, and that's one of the things that struck me now that I've had a chance to review a couple subarea plan EISs is, you know, I can't imagine the level of expense it would take to prepare one that truly covers all the potential developments that would happen.
Yeah, right.
And it seems like, I mean, I'll be honest, it seems like for very many projects that almost all of them would need supplemental review. You know, I'm sure that there are some that can be completely covered by a subarea plan EIS, but that actually doing that assessment like the SEPA process requires, you know, that's specific to the project, because it says it has to, you know, has to, the impact of the project has to be adequately assessed by the subarea plan EIS. And I mean, you'd have to be really specific about all the projects that could happen in that subarea for that to actually be true. And so it really seems like a subarea plan EIS is more of a foundation, you know, for assessing the impact, that they'll cover a bunch of the things for you, especially some of this, you know, the more global stuff that is on a more macro scale and not just that site specific, but that it would be difficult for a subarea plan EIS to really cover everything.
I should also point out that this plan is about 13 years old, and that's a long time for any kind of plan of this scale and scope to be around without being revisited. And I think everyone at DAP feels like that should probably be something that the city of Vancouver should be looking at, because no one has, like, everything figured out at a certain time, and going forward everything is covered, you know, things change. I'm sure, like, I was just talking to Greg on the way down here, how much Vancouver has changed in the last 10, 15 years, and not necessarily everything that's happened is, like, accounted for in that EIS plan. So that's something that I think this should be considering in the near future.
We are. We're redoing it.
I think that, I guess, I would, yeah, thank you, Dennis. Yes, and a lot of the changes that have happened have come under the plan ordinance. Esther Short Park redevelopment, yeah. So yeah, I think the planned ordinance is, you know, is a well considered, well thought out kind of document, And I think that it has really good statements and policies and commitments to historic preservation and cultural resources, and recognizing how important and how important those resources are to the city of Vancouver. And but it's, I think it's that kind of that detail review is kind of where we feel like, you know, would have been nice to be able to provide more input. And historic preservation, you know, I'll probably say this later, but in historic preservation, the devil is in the details, as it is with, you know, many kinds of pursuits. That's where, you know, things in terms of our reviews, you know, will tip the balance from being, you know, an adverse to no adverse effect. So being able to sort of fine tooth those kinds of reviews. In kind of parlance that we use in our office, we talk about negative impacts or adverse effects, which is kind of a term that's used in federal project reviews. Adverse effect to the historic character of historic properties. That can affect their significance and their historic character.
So can I ask a question for clarification? I lived in Virginia a long time, so you spoke way too fast for this old country. If I understood correctly, the city prepared this EIS for the sub area, and your only role legally is to provide comments. Is that correct? And they actually approved it, or did you have to approve
that's
the plan?
That's correct. Our role is to provide comments.
Okay, and then they choose to accept them or not accept them or do whatever they choose to do with them. Just like I, as a federal agency, when I got comments from interested parties, accepted them, didn't accept them, made changes, didn't make changes. And at that point in time, if I understand you correctly, the city of Vancouver then has the authority to carry out that plan consistent with the EIS, but it's their judgment as to whether they're carrying it out consistent with the EIS.
That's,
is that correct?
That would be my understanding, Don. I guess I would say, though, that, again, archaeological resources are protected by state law.
A lot of what we're talking about is not archaeological resources in the cases of our immediate interest. Our immediate interest in everything right now is the built environment in terms of what we're talking about with the city. It's not with archaeological resources. I'm not saying they're unimportant, but that is not the focus of our concerns here tonight. Our concerns here tonight are the built environment, frankly. Not archaeological resources. And again, not that they're unimportant, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, I understand.
But just what is driving us and what are our concerns? Mm. The building's coming down. It's the fact that some things are perhaps not being addressed as well as some of us think they ought to be addressed. So that's just what I'm trying to understand. Thank you.
Yeah, I guess I would add on that be sure, Don, since you've worked, or you're a federal, you've worked with the federal agency, is that?
I was the Postal Service's Historic Preservation Officer.
Oh.
I created the program.
Oh, yeah.
Let me say that the State Historic Preservation Officers can get very involved in the built environment. I had to negotiate a lot of changes to some of our sales programs for old post offices in downtowns.
Oh, so maybe you're in our address, our list of people who we've talked to then.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Oh, okay.
I did this in the 70s. So when I went to the Postal Service, we didn't have a program to implement our survey obligations under the National Historic Preservation Act. There was no program. And so I was new to our D.C. office. I just moved to San Francisco. Don't tell anybody, but I was originally from California, but I'd moved there from San Francisco. So as the new guy on the block, they said, you're now the Historic Preservation Officer.
Yes.
And so I learned what I had to learn. I spent a lot of time working with OAHP and the Department of the Interior. We built a program regularly.
It was a long time ago.
And we surveyed virtually all our properties. So we did a very good job of that over a period of 5 to 7 years, and I put on training.
Yeah.
But I learned as I went. I mean,
good.
I didn't know anything.
Thank you.
I started, other than my personal interest in the history of this country.
Great.
Which,
thank you.
We want to talk about the Civil War sometime. I'd be happy to enlighten you on what I know.
That might be another meeting. Yes,
it might be a different meeting. Read 200 books, traveled every major battlefield in America. I'm very concerned about land preservation. So
yeah,
that's
right.
My interest here.
Right. Okay.
So Don, when a subarea plan is when an EIS for a subarea plan is done and the comments come in, the city has to respond, but doesn't mean that they have to do anything about
it. I understand that too.
So if you read the one for the downtown area, you can see that you know, and sometimes the comments say, you know, oh, we changed this or we modified this in response to your comment and other.
Believe me, I've sent in basements of the four-stall building in D.C. responding to every comment received on multiple EISs. So I understand that too.
So in essence, DAP is, when it comes to the built environment, is more of an advisory voice rather than a regulatory, because the state doesn't have the same legal protections for the built environment as it does for archaeology.
Yes.
Kind of taking that.
Yes. Again, our role is providing comments. Again, archaeological sites are protected absolutely by state law, and require a permit. And there's damages for any violation or damage, knowing or unknowing, damage to those resources.
You actually have more authority over federal actions because of our federal agency's obligation to comply with the National Historic Preservation Act.
Well, I guess I would say, Don, to a point.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I know maybe others don't know, but you're referring to the Section 106 process from the National Historic Preservation Act.
Still consultation.
But again, it's a consultation process, and can't stop projects. Although many people think we do, we don't. We're providing comments to you as in the Postal Service when you were there.
You were tough on us, though. And that was good. It was a good thing, by the way.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. I know that probably you're...
It saved a lot of important buildings, important to communities, to local communities.
And again, our comments were just comments, and all we can ask for is mitigation. So we can ask you, we can make a lot of recommendations like redesign, don't do this, but the bottom line is you can do what you want to. But under 106, you know, you come to the table with mitigation.
There is a fiduciary responsibility. And I would like to say during my tenure, we took that fiduciary responsibility very seriously.
Good. Good. And we have many historic post offices still around to show for that.
I would like to move the meeting along. I think this has been a good conversation, but I think we need to kind of get into the second half of the DAP's presentation. We're sitting at a little past 7 o'clock, so.
Yeah, you'll be sick and tired of hearing from me. Oh, okay.
Sorry. No, not at all. Not at all.
Okay. So let me just sort of start by saying, thank you, Sharon, for inviting us. I'm sorry that Stephanie could not be here, but of course Stephanie was not feeling well, and we've been very, very instructed to be very careful regarding treatment of any kind of illnesses in the office. So Stephanie was playing it safe by not coming. So. I appreciate Dennis being able to fill in for her. But again, thank you for the opportunity to come down and present about SEPA, as well as the Washington State Historic Preservation Plan 2020 to 2025. So I might be repeating a little bit of what maybe Dennis has presented as well, and what we've kind of discussed already. But I think that this is a really good follow-on kind of conversation to maybe delve in more in terms of our discussions and kind of the points and questions you've been asking. But the point let me say that about this slide that you're looking at now, Inhabiting Our History is the title that we've given to our new plan that we're updating. And it's Inhabiting Our History. And that title and the photograph that you have here, I think, in my mind, says a lot about where we're going with our preservation plan. So I hope you maybe pick up on that as we move forward. when I discuss more in terms of what our goals are and what we're trying to accomplish. So next slide, please. So again, as Don has been kind of talking about, and Dennis has mentioned as well in terms of his presentation, the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966 is what I call kind of the foundation of the modern historic preservation movement or profession. And that act, passed in 1966, calls for many different things that I would say really established historic preservation as good public policy, as well as professionalizing it. And as a result of the many provisions in this act that created the Section 106 process that Don referred to, created the State Historic Preservation Officer and the State Historic Preservation Office in all 50 states and territories. But it also did this, so I pulled this. It shall be the responsibility of the State Historic Preservation Officer, or the SHPO, as we refer to that position, to administer the State Historic Preservation Program. And what that refers to is our agency and the work that we do, Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, which she is the director of, and to prepare and implement a comprehensive statewide historic preservation plan. And in the lower right-hand corner, you will see the cover of the current historic preservation plan, which is entitled Getting the Future Right. And that is what we're currently working under, and I brought a few copies of the executive summary that we're currently working on, and I don't have one for all of you, but I can pass out these for you to take a look at while we're talking. So next slide, please. So in terms of administering the State Historic Preservation Planning process and administering the State Historic Preservation Program throughout the nation, the National Park Service is the federal agency that really kind of directs and shapes the preservation planning process and what we are charged to do. So these are stipulations of what our plan needs to address and needs to encompass. So all of these, I know you can read these, but again, it needs to have a statewide focus. So the important part, the important message is that preservation plan that we are all working to develop addresses the state in its entirety, has active public involvement. And so I consider our meeting here today to be kind of a manifestation of that. So my talking to you about the preservation plan and the process is a part of that engagement and that involvement. Has a wide variety of preservation relevant information. So again, this is my lecture about preservation is not a silo, and that it affects and is affected by all kinds of endeavors and interests, including the economy and demographics and the natural environment and everything that we're involved in today that we're talking about affects what we do. And likewise, we feel like we affect, you know, those endeavors as well. And the plan needs to address that. It addresses the full range of historic and cultural resource types. So in some of Dennis's examples, he showed you some examples. But in my slide, I'll add on to that things such as landscapes, which we refer to as historic landscapes or cultural landscapes, traditional cultural properties or places, which we call TCPs. But even beyond that, underwater resources. And even beyond that, the Park Service is encouraging us to consider things that are what we might call non-traditional historic properties, such as folk life, languages, other kinds of resources that are not as tangible as the buildings, the structures, the districts, the objects that we typically address in preservation and in the National Register of Historic Places program. So we're kind of pushing the envelope in this regard. And we also need to coordinate with other planning efforts in the state. So other state agencies, federal agencies, local agencies, private organizations, all are doing plans, and we need to be able to coordinate with those plans as much as possible. And the note here is that the implementation of the State Preservation Plan is directly linked to our work as a as the State Historic Preservation Office. So our work directly needs is directly tied to our work as the State Historic Preservation Office and our funding from the National Park Service. Next slide. So some basically overviews of what does the State Historic Preservation Plan do. So it basically communicates a vision for where we want to wind up after the five-year planning cycle. It identifies our partners to achieve those goals and timelines. It communicates the goals, the strategies, and the specific tasks to a broad audience to achieve those goals. And it also discusses in narrative the trends, the threats, the opportunities for historic preservation in the state. So I think that probably for those of you in planning, who work in planning, you know, who have gone through a comprehensive planning exercise or process, I mean, this is very much what you do. You know, you're looking at what the trends are, assessing what the threats are, the opportunities, and, you know, cycling that information into our planning process so we can do a good job in terms of projecting what we need to do and accomplish in our five-year planning cycle. Next slide, please. So how does DAP use the plan? So basically, again, harking back to a previous slide, we need to be able to tie our work and our effort back to this plan. And we do that on our annual work plan. So we do that by working up a series of tasks we want to achieve in our fiscal year planning year, such as administering the Certified Local Government Program, providing grants to our CLGs, doing studies, attending conferences, doing education and outreach, on and on and on. That all needs to be tied back to the preservation plan. The plan guides identification of our partners to achieve the task. So in the plan, we will identify our partners. So we will make an attempt to identify the partners, such as our certified local governments. So you are identified as one of our partners. And projects receiving grant funding support the preservation plan. So again, like our certified local government grants that we were discussing earlier, need to relate and support the objectives, the tasks in our plan, our goals, as well as other kinds of goals or other kinds of grant programs that we receive funding to achieve. For example, last year we received funding from the legislature to undertake grants to the Eby's Landing National Historic Reserve to do preservation work there as a result of federal actions that have been affecting the historic character of those resources. So we need to be able to tie our grant programs back to the supporting the goals of the preservation plan. Okay, next slide. So in preparing to come here, Sharon and I talked. We had a conversation, and she specifically made the request, which was a good one, and we already talked about that in previous presentations, but how can the preservation plan apply to you? How can you, as the Preservation Commission for Clark County and Vancouver, use the plan? So I think our discussion already is really a good example. Share in the conversations about state, regional, national historic preservation issues, trends, goals, and efforts. So again, the preservation plan is all about assessing what the opportunities, the threats are. So I think We had that conversation just a few moments ago. So the plan is kind of your, you know, your kind of license to have those conversations in your community. Understand the roles to be played in implementing the plan. So again, it's clear you as the Historic Preservation Commission have a clear and important, if not critical, role in implementing the plan. And indeed, you will see that you are called out as being a partner, a supporting role in doing that. I mean, you are essentially the voice of historic preservation in your community. And you should be able to be able to play a role in that plan that is based upon public input and your input. Also, engagement with decision makers on cultural resource issues and questions. So again, I think your work is clear in terms of your engagement and your responsibility to provide your perspective, provide information, provide your expertise on cultural resource issues and questions that come up in your community. I mean, you are the body with expertise and agency with expertise to try to engage and provide that information. Use and support and use for support and advocacy or credibility in decision-making processes. So theoretically, the preservation plan is based upon public input. We've heard from people from all walks of life in the community, in the state, including tribes, property owners, decision makers, planners, the private sector. And that's, you know, we take that for, you know, as being what the people want to see, the public wants to see engage with the preservation plan. So that, you know, we see as being the reason for establishing, for reaching the kind of decisions and recommendations that we make, as well as making recommendations to others for their decision-making process. And it is also seen as being a way to help implement your kinds of goals within your jurisdiction. So I would say that I know that a few years ago, we gave you an award for your efforts to engage with your local city council members, your county commissioners. We gave you an award for undertaking that effort, which I think is a good example for how you could and how you are implementing the state preservation plan to make that outreach, to reach out to decision makers, telling them what you're all about and why it's important for them to consider cultural resources in their decision making process. I think it's really very clear and important. Next slide. So current goal statements. So the handout that I was passing out to you with the executive summary, some are relate these three preservation goals that we had in our getting the future right. So enhance communities by actively engaging historic preservation with other forces shaping our environment. Engage a broad spectrum of the public in preservation. Improve access to information. Strengthen policies and planning processes to enhance informed decision-making for the cross-disciplinary decision-making for managing cultural and historic resources. So that's kind of a wordy goal, but I think you understand that. And I think that you will see that that's very much carried forward in our plan for the next 5 years. Next slide. So getting back to kind of our discussion earlier about tribal engagement and the fact that we seek and hope that tribes and tribal governments and our tribal historic preservation officers will be engaged in our planning process. We included in our current plan, and you will see this published in the executive summary that I handed out, this statement or this excerpt from that statement. And this is, I'll dwell a little bit about on this, and the fact that when we went through the plan development the last time around, we we decided to take this step to include this statement in the plan to recognize that tribes and tribal members have a very, very significant and very sensitive and important stake and concern and interest in our cultural resources in the state. And they deserve that deference in terms of how they view that. And this statement is saying that their perspective on cultural resources and our past and how we move forward can be very different from the way that I would or those of us sitting around the table might take that perspective. And this is kind of a reminder about that. So that sort of keeps us kind of aware of that difference and how we need to pay attention to that perspective. And we are working to incorporate another similar statement in our next go around. So we've got one that that we're working on sharing. So next. We have a process, of course. So we have a steering committee that we have engaged with. We have 30 members from what we say are cross-section of the preservation community and other stakeholders, not necessarily preservationists, on that steering committee. We have several representatives from Southwest Washington. Holly Chamberlain is on our steering committee. I know you know her. Nick Fazio has been representing previously to when he was representing Collets County, and that's sort of our local government. And they've been involved in setting the vision for the preservation plan and the guiding principles, as well as shaping our public participation, process. So next slide. So this is our draft vision statement that we have drafted for this go-round. Our shared heritage not only enriches the present, it can also help shape the future. The state plan seeks to engage with the people of Washington to help them take ownership as enthusiastic stewards of that heritage. Together, we can honor the stories and places of our diverse communities, strengthen economic vitality, promote sustainability, and enhance our sense of place. So I think that I hope that this might tie back to that first slide that I showed you with the picture and the title, Inhabiting Our Heritage. So, and I'll be asking you to share your comments about this vision statement as well. Next slide. So this gets back to kind of our public participation process. So we have had a SurveyMonkey questionnaire that has been circulating, and we received hundreds of comments back from that outreach effort. So this is kind of what my distillation of that response has been. These are themes that were very consistently came out. Education and training, need more of it, need all of it, need it all the time, more of it, everywhere. Land use and growth management. There's wide recognition that land use decision making and growth management planning has major impacts on our work. Cultural living heritage. This is kind of the effort to expand the definition of what historic preservation is. You know, we typically, as Alex knows, in our office, we're focused on the National Register of Historic Places, which is buildings, structures, districts, objects, and so forth. But again, this is we're being pushed to push the envelope beyond those five property types that we typically deal with in our work, in our office. Housing. I know in Vancouver, as it is across the state and nation, housing and providing housing is a major issue. And we feel like, and our constituents have echoed that that's something we need to be aware of and promote how preservation should play a role in that. Disaster planning. We've been made very aware of how disasters and emergency events can affect cultural resources and in ways that are make them more vulnerable than other kinds of resources might be. We need to be prepared for that. Climate change kind of goes along with that. So we're facing all sorts of disasters, you might say, or emergencies that are maybe being triggered by climate change. So we need to understand and convey that our resources are affected, and we need to be prepared for that. And of course, the economy. You know, everything is, you know, we're affected by the economy, and we think that we play a role in the economy, in a healthy economy as well. This is kind of, I don't think this is should be of any surprise to you, but this is basically very consistent in terms of what we heard and heard from the comments that we received through our questionnaire process, as well as other kinds of meetings that we had. Next. So what we heard, lots. So I know I'm not going to read all of this, and I don't expect you to, but the point is here, I put this slide in to make the point that we had lots of comments, hundreds and hundreds of comments, and they were fully, they ranged from one end of the spectrum to the other. And I just picked out just a sample here to sort of represent represent that we had lots of comments, lots of very widely ranging comments in terms of wanting recommendations that we received and that we review and take into consideration and considered in terms of how we formulated our plans and how we're moving forward. So, again, I'm not expecting you to read that, but just to let you know that lots of words and lots of comments. Next. So getting back to the question that we circulated online and we took around to various meetings around the state, these were some of the questions, and I wanted to share these. I'm not going to go into this real detail, but these are just a sample of the questions that we were had in the questionnaire. So I want to make the point here that who do you think should have a role in protecting historic places that matter to you or to others? So I'll make the point here that local governments came out top in the questionnaire at 92% of our respondents checked that, local governments. So I'm looking at you. Next slide. Who do you think is most effective at protecting / preserving historic places? Well, look at this, local governments came out on top again. So again, you are the ones. Next slide. Most important issues. Again, I don't think there's any surprises here. I think this sort of runs the gamut of the issues that we just sort of put out in one of the previous slides. Next. Which of these tools do you think would be most effective at preserving historic places? Again, probably no surprise here. Financial incentives came out, you know, most of the, as the most kind of favored, you know, favored response or incent or way to be effective at preserving historic places. Again, you know, the carrot as opposed to the stick approach. But I think you will see the other, you know, other things as well that we, you know, are valid and that we try to address. Next. I think this is probably just sort of beating a dead horse. These are just sort of a selection of comments that we received. Again, but I think this one is more germane to the message to, or the recognition, I should say, of the fact that planning and comprehensive planning, growth management planning, does, there's this recognition that there's that interaction and that impact, that effect that we need to be aware of and to approach. I think that's the point of this slide. Next. Some takeaways. So I want to, again, this might be repeating myself, so I apologize for that, but a takeaway is that this is kind of my, you know, what how I took in this these comments and how what I distill from it is, and again, this should not be, this should be, you know, second nature to you, but historic preservation is really felt and experienced at the local level. And I think the comments, and it, this was not news to me, but it's the, but the our public participation process really enforces me, and it always really strikes home to me about how preservation is really a local issue. And I always say this at meetings, addressing preservation commissions or planning commissions, is that preservation really happens at the local level. You are on the front lines of preservation. You are the decision makers. We at the preservation office, you know, we make our plans, we make our comments, review projects in front of our computers in Olympia, but it's really you here, you know, facing your constituents, your stakeholders, that are really making important decisions and making efforts that are really important, and that's where the rubber meets the road. And more information sharing, more information the better, more education outreach, all the time, everywhere, as much as possible. More incentives. We need to have more incentives because that's the bottom line is, you know, is the bottom line is the bottom line. Do a better job of telling our stories. I'll talk more about that later. Broaden the definition of historic preservation. And sense of place. So that was kind of another message that came out is that we really do have a corner on the market in terms of being able to convey, establish a sense of place that is intangible. You know it when you see it, but it's definitely, I think, that preservation plays a key role in fostering and enabling. Next. Okay, so I spent a lot of time. I'm sorry about that, but this is really kind of the important part of my presentation to you today. So what I'm going to pass out to you, Dennis is going to pass it around that way, is our draft goals and our strategies that we're working on for our updated preservation plan. So I'll preface this by saying that this is really kind of very important to me. This is really kind of the first opportunity that I've had to share this. So Sharon's inviting us here today really has pushed me to really kind of finalize our language to come to and ship out as a draft that we want to share with the public. So you are seeing this. You are the first to see. To lay eyes on these goals, other than our staff in the office. So consider yourself special, but also comes with that responsibilities. So and tasks. So I want to share with you, go through these, if you will indulge me with that time and hearing me prattle on about what the goals are, and which are there are five as opposed to three. At currently, and to go through the strategies real quickly, and then the tasks, the specific tasks are in the document that I'm passing around to you. And notice again that this is draft, so this is just all very preliminary. So this is, you are the first to see this. But I want to go through these with you and just to provide you with an opportunity to provide or ask me any questions about, you know, what you're, you know, where you're coming from. And I don't expect you to provide any comments for me tonight. You can if you want to, but there will be another more opportunity for you to do that. And again, this has not even gone to our steering committee, so the steering committee will probably have changes. But so this is very preliminary. But goal one is promote historic preservation as the, quote, preferred alternative, unquote, when it comes to implementing programs, policies, and projects that shape how our communities look, feel, and change. So you can go ahead and read the preamble, but I guess I've been thinking of these goals in my mind as being kind of in sound bites or bumper stickers. In my mind, this is the preservation toolbox for planners. So I think this sort of fits in well with the discussions we've had all here already. So this is kind of responding to our recognition that comprehensive planning and planned action ordinances and other planning actions and reviews play a strong role in preservation, and we need to do a better job of reaching out to planners and providing planners with the tools to make those reviews more easier, more substantive, provide that information that is needed to make the decisions that we're talking about today, this evening. So next slide. So these, as you can see, if you want to follow along, under goal one, these are the three strategies that we've come up with. Again, you can go ahead and read them either on the slide or in front of you. But again, it's to better engage with planners, decision makers in land use, property owners, to better prepare them, to encourage that kind of assuming stewardship and ownership of the process and the resources that are affected by planning processes. Okay? And I think that you will see in the document that this will involve like developing templates or documents, model documents that we can promote, provide to our stakeholders as being kind of things that we would like to see in like development regulations, sub-area plans, other kinds of documents that we can encourage communities to adopt. There's also kind of this effort to increase, I'm looking at C. This is getting at, again, kind of a point that I made earlier about the workload. So we want to be able to increase the presence of preservation expertise in terms of the review. So increased staffing in our office and increased preservation staffing at federal, state, and local agencies, as well as companies and consultants who are doing these kinds of work for on behalf of applicants.
Okay. Greg, on B, I just want to say I'd like to talk to you on that one. That's what I do in my day job, and where sustainability regulation is going has left historic preservation way, way behind. And so there was
Agreed.
A comment about the greenest building, where sustainability is now, has pretty much just knocked the feet out from under that argument. And
I would agree with you, Sean.
And where, you know, they're going with building performance standards that apply to all existing buildings and embodied energy, like the direction that the embodied energy regulations are going should advantage historic buildings, but the way they're going right now, we're going to disadvantage historic buildings. And so I would really like to be a part of that conversation. I think I can help.
This is your opportunity, Sean. So that's why I'm showing this to you. So I think you'll see more that touches upon this issue, but I will put you down as a supporting partner in implementing this then.
Yes.
Okay. But yes, so any feedback would be greatly appreciated. So thank you. Can we move? You want to move on? So okay, next slide, please. Goal two. So expand historic preservation work to a broad spectrum of places, persons, and experiences that have shaped our communities. So this is getting back to our living heritage goal, and again, this directly responds to the letter that you sent to us last year recommending this. So this is responsive to that. If you want to go to the next slide, this is our preamble. But again, we agree. And no, next slide, yes. And we've not heard that only from you, but we've heard that, again, in our comments. Our feedback was, again, we need to expand the definition to include other resources. So you'll see our approaches by these means, increased efforts to identify those resources and create the forums that can make that better, make that happen. I would say that we've had almost unanimous kind of support or agreement that this is really important. So I think this will be really something that is exciting to make happen. I mean, the SHPO saw this, and she is really kind of excited about this too. I think the good thing is, I think that this will be easy to implement as well. So, whereas the others are not so much. But anyway, so that's goal two. Again, that's the Living Heritage goal. Next slide. Goal three, share with ever larger and diverse audiences our rich and valuable stories in innovative formats and engaging ways. So this is my bumper sticker thought about this is, we need to do a better job of telling our stories. This is what this goal is about. And this preamble is about the fact that there are some stories that might be better kept to those communities who value them, but there are other kinds of stories out there that you know probably better than I do, that we would really do a service to our communities, our public, our nation, to share those, and we need to do a better job of doing that. Next slide. And so here are the strategies that we have for that. I think that we need to do more of it, but we also need to be very innovative and creative in doing that. And I'm not, you know, as you know, I'm not a young person, but I know there are many creative people out there, or many creative people out there, regardless of their age, who could do a really good job of doing that, that we need to tap into. So next slide. Goal four. Invest our energy, expertise, and passion for preservation in the places, people, and organizations where decisions affecting our heritage are made. So, goal one, I told you, was what I see as the preservation toolkit for planners. So this is what I see as the goal for the preservation toolkit for preservationists. So, again, as we stated before, preservation takes place at the local level, and that is where preservation is most intensely felt and addressed at. And we need to provide you with the tools to do your work. And so this is sort of what this is getting at. Next slide. So again, this gets back to what kinds of incentives can we put into place, or maybe publicize more existing tools that might be already in place. Share data and information. Again, this is that never-ending kind of need to be able to share data, generate data, make it available. Probably we need to do a better job of making that available to our public, to our stakeholders, and to you as well, to sort of demonstrate, the economic benefits, the environmental benefits, the sustainability benefits of what we do. And then work with tribal governments to raise that awareness of the need to protect traditional cultural places and the landscape associated with that. So that's kind of carrying, again, the living heritage goal, but being more proactive and engaging with the tribes more proactively in working with them to achieve that goal. Okay. Okay, move on to the next slide. Okay. Shake up the way we prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural emergencies and the impacts of climate change on archaeological, cultural, and historic resources. So this is my disaster planning, goal. So this is the goal that we want to implement strategies and tasks that will get the preservation community, cultural resource protection, cultural resource managers to be more engaged with emergency management planners, and to recognize that cultural resources are particularly vulnerable to disasters, climate change, and we need to be proactive in terms of doing that preparation, that upfront planning, doing a better job of responding and recover, and be resilient. So if you wanted to move to the next slide, so here you go. So the vision is, again, is to providing, you know, developing the tools to do that, developing plans, the toolbox, what are kind of best practices there might be out there to do this, engaging with local emergency management agencies and managers to plan for, prepare for, respond to emergency events. Establish those lines of communication to provide them with the information they need to make decisions. So, for example, just last week we hosted a workshop in Tacoma on adapting historic buildings to flooding. Again, getting at best practices, how can we, you know, what kind of approaches can we take that to try to retrofit and secure historic properties in the event of floods. So that's kind of, I think, an example of how we see this as being implemented, is kind of provide those kinds of information, those forums, to practitioners who will be the responders and being the planners for that kinds of those kinds of responses. So that's, in essence, is goal five.
On this one, I think you might consider a D, how historic buildings can actually be a part of emergency response, since so many of them are, especially our pre-war buildings, are built with passive systems. A lot of times they can continue to operate after a disaster when services have been lost, when modern buildings cannot. So, you know, after the big blackout in New York City and about 15 years ago, you know, they found that people who lived in older apartments were able to stay in them, you know, because they had daylighting and operable windows and ventilation, while people who lived in modern apartments
couldn't. Yeah, yeah.
And so while they are vulnerable, they also have a kind of resiliency that modern buildings sometimes do not.
That's a very good point. Thank you, Sean. Yes. Thank you. But that's the kind of word that we need to spread. So, yeah. I think this is the last slide, except for my concluding slide, if you want to move to, yes. So my thank you, but then thank you for the opportunity to take so much of your time here tonight and to be kind of the guinea pigs for this very early draft, but also again to make the pitch to you. Now that you've seen this and now that you've provided this, to invite, encourage your taking the time to go over this and let me know if you have any comments. about this draft. And again, this, of course, we will be taking this draft to our steering committee to take a look at, so there will probably be other changes to this wordsmithing and probably kind of some of the comments that you've already echoed here. And again, that will be revised and go out again to a wider audience, you know, the entire state, as a matter of fact. So your help there would be also helpful for getting the word out when we reach that point. That would be great. So with that kind of pitch to you I appreciate you taking the time and to hear me out on this, but also to take a look at this and be engaged with the process as we move forward. And you know, don't be shy about emailing me or calling me or you know, you're talking to me later on or having me back, in essence, to go through this in more detail. So I think with that, I'll conclude. But of course, you know, ask if there are any other questions or comments that you want to kind of bring out.
Do you have an electronic version you can share with us? It might be easier for us to get your comments that way. That would be easier for me. Maybe that's just self-serving.
Yeah, I'll do that. Again, though, you know, again, just keep in mind that this is, again, very, very, this has not even gone to, gone out to our steering committee. If that would make it easier for you. But just keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd like to suggest one thing. Goal 4, to me, which is about financial incentives.
Yes.
Largely. So I'm very active in an organization, the American Battlefield Trust.
The American what?
American Battlefield Trust.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we preserve land from the Revolution, the War of 1812, and the Civil War. While the Park Service has saved 40,000 acres in the last 25 years, we've saved 80,000. We've done it with all private contributions. But what it takes to really have an impact where someone wants to do something that you don't think's in the best interest of historic preservation in the long run, it takes money. And if we cannot come up with a way to provide financial incentives, and including it, this, I'm very enlightened that you're happy that you're talking about even acquiring property to protect and preserve it. I think that's the only long-term solution to some of the problems that we're going to face with protecting historic properties in the long run. It comes down to private owners saying, I've got two opportunities. One is to make a lot of money and another is to make nothing. And let me think, I've got my grandchildren to think of. They've got other pressing needs besides historic preservation. You've got to make it financially attractive to them sometimes. And I don't think enough attention has been paid to that since I've been involved in historic preservation ever. And I think this is really, really important. The incentives that are there now are fine, but they're not enough for most people.
I guess I would say I agree with you entirely, and I'm sure many of us in the preservation community would agree with you entirely. It's just how do we get there?
How do you get there? Because you're not talking about the funding priorities.
And yes, and yeah, you know, governments at all levels are strapped for funding. You know that well better than I do. So it's hard to get money from your city council members and county commissioners and state legislators and state representatives.
But I think if you take this up as an issue and present it in a positive way as to how important it might be, I think this could be a very valuable way to improve the probability of getting some support that could help in some critical projects.
Well, I hope you join with us in carrying that message.
Certainly will.
We have, I would say that our, you know, our state historic preservation officer, Allison Brooks, has been great in terms of doing that. So under her watch, she's established our county courthouse historic preservation grants, you know, which you benefited from here. We've got our Heritage Barn grant program. We've got now our Historic Cemeteries grant program. And she's really plugging away at and laying the seeds for historic theaters. She's found that, interestingly enough, she's found that if we sort of go to the siloed approach, that seems to be, if you kind of tap into like a special interest group, like you did with the battlefields, and line up that support, you can get some dollars. So, but you know, for general kind of programming, it's kind of tough. But your comments are very much appreciated, and I'm glad that you will be engaged. So we'll look forward to hearing from you.
Does anybody else have any commissioners?
Have a question. Is this the 20 through 2019 synopsis of the plan, that's available online?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Rock, speak into your
Yes, mind. If you go to our website, you can access it. It's not on our homepage, but if you go, I can't remember, but I can share that with you, Rock.
Okay. Greg, I have a question. How would you say that the last preservation plan, what would you say the success rate was? You know, the goals that were set out and the goals met, you know, now that you're at the end of that 5-year block, looking back on it, what would you say?
That's a really good question for Alex. That's one that I need to come up with and put into the preservation plan I need to do that assessment. So what I have told other people with that question is that I think that it's been a mixed bag. So I think there have been successes, but there's also ones where we've not so much. But I think that there are some of those tasks that are kind of in process. So I think that we've made inroads in terms of like state agency staffing has come up. So we've had this kind of been an ongoing issue, and certainly in our office, getting state agencies to get cultural resource managers and cultural resource expertise on staff. So DFW has really come on board. RCO is doing better. Ecology is coming along. Of course, there's a long ways to go, but there are signs of improvement, so certainly better than, you know, 5 years ago. There's been more, I guess I would say there's progress in terms of our engagement in disaster planning. So this is really something that's important to me. And so I've really spent a lot of time, well, not a lot of time, but as much time as I can afford to become engaged with our state emergency management division in terms of the FEMA disaster planning process. So again, we're not there yet. And you can see that by goal 5. But we're working on it. So I guess I would say, Alex, it's a mixed bag. So some successes, not successes, and some we're working on it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Greg, for that. And you too, Dennis, for making the trip down.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure.
Staff, have any questions? Okay. Well, at this point, I think we'll open it up for public comment. Anybody left there in the? do we have any public comment this month? No. Okay. Well, any other business to any new business, old business? No. Okay. Well,
I'd like to move that we adjourn.
I second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very, very interesting.